this topic is sometimes also called daily life practice. But I want tonight to look at it from the point of view of the Dharma, of taking the teachings and your meditation and building a way of life, a mindful way of life. A teacher at Spirit Rock who's been very important in my own spiritual growth, Sharda Rogel, jokes that her friends have asked her how she fits practice into her life. And she says, it's no problem, I just fit life into my practice. And it really is pretty easy when you do it that way. Or at least simple. Well, it works when you do it that way. When people talk about daily life practice, they often say that it's about coming back to mindfulness, which is the same thing we do when we meditate. So in retreats, the teachers will say at the end of a sitting, all right, now we have 45 minutes or whatever for walking meditation. When you get up from your sitting, literally sitting, when you stand, be aware of this change in posture. Watch how your body moves, how that feels. Stay mindful. And then as you move, be aware of the movement and carry that right on through to your walking meditation and then to your meals, which are also taken in silence, to your work period, to your getting ready to go to sleep at night, and to your waking up. So you're basically maintaining mindfulness. In fact, it's possible to do it even while you're sleeping. And it's possible as we come back over and over to mindfulness to have a day in our lives that's pretty full of mindfulness. As I'm talking during this Dharma talk, I'm going to be giving you some of the bits and pieces of teachings that are in the Satipatthana Sutta under the fourth foundation of mindfulness. Well, you might ask, what are the first three? Well, they are the body, the mind, and liking and not liking things. And then Dharma. And a lot of teachers kind of punt on Dharma, but in the sutta, it's a list of things. It's the list of lists. So that's, you know, capital L of capital L lists. The Four Noble Truths, the Five Aggregates, the Five Hindrances, the Six Sense Spheres, and the Seven Factors of Awakening. I've studied the sutta many times, and I don't believe there's any time that I've said, okay, this is the third factor of awakening that's in my awareness right now. What I have found is that if I try to be fully aware of the present moment from the perspective of everything I have learned about the teachings, then these lists of lists flash by. I've dropped kind of the scholarship here. I'm not taking the moment to say, well, this is on that list or the other. But as my experience unfolds in meditation as well as in life, all of this stuff does come up. For daily life practice, a lot of times the place where we start is, of course, coming back to the mindfulness. And people look for triggers, things that will remind you to come back to this awareness of what your full experience is in the moment, how the body feels, what's going on in the mind, whether you like it or don't like it, how it got there, what made it go away. I think the best trigger, at least in my experience, has been the breath. Because in any given moment, I'm breathing. And in meditation, I focus on it. I know what that feels like. I know what it feels like to take a breath when I'm uptight. And that happens pretty frequently during the day. So if I am over and over reminding myself, what does it feel like to breathe right now? Then I have a pretty continuous stream of mindfulness. Some people get a lot of mileage out of remembering to be mindful every time they stand up or change positions. I know a lot of people who set a chime on their iPhone or their computer or whatever. Some teachers say, stay mindful of what your left foot feels like, or some appendage. There are some people who do have trouble, it can trigger some difficult emotional states to, say, pay attention to the heartbeat or, you know, anything that's not peripheral. So maybe the elbow or the shoulder, something like that, is safe for those individuals. I have one friend who went around putting post-its on places where she would look, where her glance would fall during the day, and that would bring her back to mindfulness. Until she got so used to seeing the post-its that they lost that particular power. I think the very best way to get anchored is to practice, to meditate every day. And for people who say, I just don't have time, my retort is, do it for just a little while. For many, many years, I have been practicing right when I wake up. I watch myself breathe all the way through until I have strung three breaths together that I've been aware of continuously. And at that point, I say metta, I do my physical therapy stretches, and I get out of bed. So I have begun the day with a period of concentration and mindfulness. And that's a feeling that I can come back to at any time during the day. Regardless of what trigger I'm using, it's fresh in my memory. whether you do it that way or at some other time in the day, it is really good to make a habit of developing some concentration and some mindfulness. Whether you tie that to an event that happens every day, like you do it after a meal, or when you're taking public transportation, if you're saying metta as a practice, do that when you're driving. Just make it a habit. That's the goal. Part of your way of living. Another good trigger is the physical feeling of stress. It's really good. And it's one of the reasons why I urge you in meditation to look for the way your body is feeling in response to your thoughts. And if there is tension, particularly, get to know it. Give it your attention so that when it arises during the day, it will act as a trigger. It's your body telling you, hey, pay attention. Suffering is happening now. You have the opportunity to study it, to see where it comes from and what makes it go away. And why do we want to know that? Because that's what it's all about. It's about avoiding the arising of suffering and hastening the departure of it once it's there. Another really good trigger for mindfulness is watching what we do, and to watch it from the point of view of ethics. There are guidelines that are given in the Dharma, guidelines for speech, for conduct, for use of intoxicants or sexual energy, honesty. The basic principle is non-harming. And if we hold the intention to not harm, to be helpful, whatever our conduct is, minimize the harm that we do to other beings and be generous and helpful as much as possible. If that's our overarching intention, then we can notice when that intention is being violated. Again, there'll be a tension in the body. And we can investigate that. How does it feel to contemplate or to have done something we really don't want to do? Something that our conscience has told us we don't want to do. Again, we're studying the source of suffering. Maybe this is suffering that we're inflicting on others. That's sort of a subjective, objective way of looking at it. But it's also our own suffering. Of course, what we inflict on others, we also experience through compassion and the basic connection that we have with all other beings. But just going against our better nature causes suffering to arise in our own bodies and minds. So that is a potential trigger whenever we notice that we're not doing the kinds of conduct and speech that our ideals have told us we want to. Life has a way of waking us up with crises, too. Things like bereavement or material loss, ill health. So when these things, these major life upsets happen, usually among people who practice, it's a great opportunity for growth. I was involved with hospice, the Zen Hospice Project, for many years, and I went for a retreat, and the speaker was a longtime Zen practitioner who had been diagnosed with brain cancer, and it wasn't treatable, and unless, you know, some intervening accident occurred, it was going to be the cause of his death sooner than he had expected to die. And when he told his priest that, the response was, oh, what a great opportunity. Because it is. I mean, that might sound callous, but these crises that we're presented with by life bring out the whole spectrum of responses. And they're so riveting that we almost can't help but pay attention. So I think back after the crash in 08 and the current president's team came in, they said, never waste a crisis. Well, if we don't waste crises, if we take that opportunity, we're going to be paying an awful lot of attention to ourselves in these times anyway. If we can bring the Dharma to bear on it, it can tell us a lot. And the kinds of things we want to be looking at when we bring the Dharma to bear are the way our minds work around them and what takes us away from the mindfulness. Of course, there are the five hindrances, the issues of energy. Are we restless or dopey? The issues of dissatisfaction with the present moment. Are we craving something different or feeling aversion to what is? And then doubt. The thought in the mind that, oh, I really don't know what I'm doing. This isn't working. I'm not doing it right. Blah, 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 blah. You know, we have this idea of the mind as being kind of a unitary thing that I'm in control of. And one of the things we learn through teachings like the aggregates, the different aspects, the components of experience, is that there's a lot going on that I am not aware of. And I noticed this just the other day when I was putting together my breakfast. First thing I ever do is pour a cup of coffee, and I like just the right amount of cream in my coffee. And I had drunk it down while there was just a little, and I was spreading the butter on the toast, and I noticed that it was getting kind of cold, the coffee was. So I was going to refill it. And before I had any awareness of intending to do so, my mind had poured in just the right amount of cream for the amount of coffee that would fill up the cup. And as I put the pot back down, my mind said to me, oh, you thought of that, you just didn't notice. I don't know where I was in all of that. Was I not noticing? What level of the mind was operating? So, as we watch what's going on in daily life, we can look at our rationalizations, the messages that we give ourselves or that we get from our subconscious about what was going on in that situation. Actually, I think the rationalizations that we give ourselves are wonderful opportunities to look at attitudes and moods and the other background factors of the mind. Also, memories and associations that some event evokes can be very laden with suffering. And looking at, where did this come from? Why is it haunting me now? I mean, you can get kind of Freudian about it, but just looking for the connections, the cause and effect, reason for the uncomfortable feeling that's in the body at the moment. Also looking for those moments when you're not mindful and why. Why was I not aware of pouring in the cream? Was it that I was moving so fast? Did I have something else going on? Was I really worried about the thing that I had to do after breakfast? It's good to notice when the mind is tranquil, and then the moment when the mind stops being tranquil, if we can see it. But for example, you know, if you take a moment before you go to work to bend over the vase that has some fragrant flowers in it and enjoy the aroma, you might notice that at that moment there's a feeling of peace. And then later, as you get into the car or you go wait at the bus stop, you notice that there's a very different feeling. Those moments when maybe there's some turmoil going on, but you realize that you're still able to watch this turmoil with a sense of stability, at least a stable awareness. A friend of mine was describing her day. She's a lawyer. She represents the child in custody cases. And she was running from one courtroom in the town hall to the other and dealing with hysterical parents and troubled children and angry judges and all of this one moment after another. And she remarked that it was amazing how much mindfulness there was. That despite all of this going on, all of this input of turmoil, there was still a point in her awareness that could just watch it, that had equanimity. And then, of course, there's always joy. Yep, that's my favorite. Joy is a wonderful opportunity to be mindful, because that can give it a little boost, sort of like MSG boosting the taste in that moment when we focus the attention on it. And notice, where did the joy come from? What caused that? What are the conditions out of which it arose? And where did they come from? Because we want to know in the future, as those conditions arise again, we want to nurture them. Because that's what it's about. Watering the flowers of happiness and not watering the weeds of suffering. So all of those things that I've been talking about that allow us to be mindful, that can occupy our attention, perhaps only for a moment, But at any moment during the day, they're all in the Dharma. They're all in the lists of lists. And they happen to us over and over. And our job is just to see them, just to be mindful, and to be aware of when you're aware of the Dharma.